Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today about Port Covington and what it means for the neighbors near it and the whole city. Sagamore, the company behind the planned Port Covington development, and six nearby South Baltimore communities signed a 30-year, multi-million dollar community benefits agreement last week. The six neighborhoods are Brooklyn, Curtis Bay, Cherry Hill, Westport, Mount Winans, and Lakeland. A key element of the deal is that it sets up a group made up of representatives of Sagamore and the neighborhoods to oversee disbursement of an estimated $39 million in funding, $10 million from Sagamore, $10 million raised by this new group, and $19 million from surcharges on commercial space in the new development and from transfer fees on the sale of property in the new Port Covington. Here's part of how the CEO of Plank Industries, Tom Geddes, described other benefits of the agreement.
In addition, Sagamore has agreed that it will be an advocate for SB6 communities for city services, businesses, and cultural attractions, and funding from public and private entities. While difficult to place a value on all of this, these commitments of advocacy and resources will in and of themselves equal millions of dollars of time, expertise, funding, and community productivity. This is a true partnership. This 30-year partnership with SB6 is all on top of another $10 million referenced by the mayor, already promised by Sagamore, to fund citywide priorities that was part of the MOU agreements announced earlier this year, and other philanthropy by Under Armour and its CEO, Kevin Plank, not to mention the thousands of hours of community service by Under Armour teammates every year. For those who are counting, the total amount from the citywide MOU and this deal, with the redevelopment fully executed as planned, could total over $50 million. And this does not include the extraordinary economic benefits to the city from the redevelopment itself, in the form of investment, economic opportunity, and most importantly, good jobs and careers for residents of our city.
That was Tom Geddes, CEO of Plank Industries. He used an acronym I think I had not used yet, SB6, to describe the six communities in South Baltimore. The deal won't go forward unless the City Council approves the big million, multi-million tax increment financing deal that Sagamore applied for. At more than $600 million, it would be the largest TIF in Baltimore history. And the project was hit with a setback this month. The U.S. Department of Transportation rejected Maryland's application for $76 million for new highway ramps off I-95 and other road work surrounding Port Covington. The Baltimore Sun's Natalie Sherman reported today that the City Council's Planning Commission will vote on the project's master plan next Thursday. With me here in the studio to discuss the agreement with South Baltimore 6 and what it means for the city as a whole are Keisha Allen, president of the Westport Neighborhood Association and a member of the South Baltimore 6. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Diana Glauber is an attorney at the nonpartisan nonprofit Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She's co-director of their Fair Housing and Community Development Project. Her expertise is in legal assistance to nonprofit organizations on fair housing issues, affordable housing development, and community preservation. She worked with the SB6 to reach this agreement with Sagamore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Dr. Lawrence Brown, assistant professor of community health and policy at Morgan State University, is here. His work focuses on race, gender, and health, as well as the impact of residential displacement and financial disinvestment on community health. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Diane Glauber, maybe a good place to start is with process. Describe what the process was like putting this together.
It was actually a very open, engaging, wonderful, community-driven process. I got involved back in April and was asked to meet with the SB6, and I'm sure Keisha will give you a little bit longer history. And we had a series of meetings, 2-3 nights a week, Saturdays, to figure out what the community wishes would happen in these six neighborhoods. The focus was on what the asks were in these six neighborhoods, again, not to focus on Port Covington itself. So through a series of basically charrettes, planning meetings, we came up with a list of needs in the community, which is attached to the document, and then determined the best course of action for securing funding and support to meet the needs of the community.
So you're describing a very open process. Were these like big meetings? Lots of community people showing up?
Well, there were there were representatives of each of these six communities and other interested parties. We tried to keep it somewhat workable, but in addition to these meetings of maybe 20,
that sounds about
sometimes
right.
30 people, the leaders in the room went back to their communities and met with them constantly during this process to make sure that all residents were engaged.
Professor Lawrence Brown, I'd like to get your sense of the process.
I wasn't involved in it. I think Keisha has.
No, I understand. I just thought you had, I was under the impression. I know you're a critic of the deal, or I think that's a fair statement, and I'm going to ask you in a few minutes why. Mm-hmm. But I thought you were in it, that part of your criticism was that you felt that the meetings were not in spaces where large numbers of people could attend them.
Well, I'm actually very happy for SB6 and their deal. What I've maintained is that there should also be a citywide benefits agreement. So as Diane and Keisha are discussing their community SB6 agreement, I'm in full agreement with that. It's the citywide benefits agreement that I think needs to be strengthened.
Okay, I'm glad you took us there because I'm confused about that. I was under the impression from some of what I've read that there would be two deals. The one about the close in neighbors, the six communities that I mentioned, and then I had this kind of vague idea that there's going to be something else. So, Diane Glauber, I'm sorry to leave you holding Keisha. I will get to you in a minute, but you're the lawyer here. Tell me what the process is in that regard.
The SB6 coalition are comprised of members of the six communities surrounding
right.
Port Covington.
And that's what I asked you about earlier.
Right. And they are only focused on the needs of their communities.
Right.
In no way are we against a citywide agreement or what Lawrence and others are trying to do when it comes to inclusionary housing, affordable housing, workforce development, and so on. And I know that Sagamore is interested in these issues as well and may make future commitments. But we were concerned about what happens in these communities.
I get that. And I don't mean to make you a spokesman for something you're not, but you all have been much watching this process much more closely than I. Is there the same kind of intensity for a citywide benefits agreement? Well, are we going to see that?
Well, I think we should be clear that one was already put together. It's in the actual TIF application itself. The issue that many of the advocates in the community have is that it's not inclusive enough. It's not expansive enough. And so we're actually pushing to include affordable housing. There's a great Housing Our Neighbors Act that would include 1,500 affordable housing units out of the, what I've been told, the fluctuating numbers, actually maybe 7,200 units, residential units that will be built in Port Covington. So we want to see 20% as the inclusionary zoning law says. And I've been pushing, and other advocates like ACLU have been pushing for fair housing, not just affordable housing, but ensuring that African Americans are adequately represented and that Port Covington doesn't become a highly segregated white community at the corner of the white L that we have here in Baltimore demographically.
Describe what you mean by the white L.
When I say the white L, I'm talking about going from Baltimore County down York Road, and there are communities that sit to the west of York Road, Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland, Charles North, Station North, Mount Belvedere, Mount Vernon, downtown. So you're moving south. And then when you hit downtown, you move east, maybe along Alice Anna. And those neighborhoods that are south of that, Harbor Point or Harbor East, Harbor, Inner Harbor, Canton, those neighborhoods are all disproportionately white. And so that's what many of us call the white L.
And you think Port Covington may be part of that?
It's at the corner. It's in the South Baltimore Community Statistical Area, according to the Baltimore Neighborhoods Indicators Alliance. It's actually the whitest community in Baltimore at 90% white, while only having 2.7% African Americans in a city that's 63% African American. So that's indicative of the high amount of segregation that we have. And that's in the South Baltimore Community Statistical Area, where Port Covington is actually located. So we're very much concerned that if this project doesn't include fair housing, then African Americans will be underrepresented and therefore racial segregation will be intensified.
That is Dr. Lawrence Brown, Assistant Professor of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here in the studio is Diana Glauber, an attorney at the Nonpartisan Nonprofit Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who worked with the six South Baltimore communities to reach the agreement, the community benefits agreement with Sagamore. And Keisha Allen is here, president of the Westport Neighborhood Association and a member of the South Baltimore Six. Keisha, you were involved in this negotiation. Tell me, because I don't have it in front of me, so tell me what the wish list was. Tell me what the community most wanted. The wish list is being passed on paper from one to another here. And I'm not asking you, I see how long it is. I am not asking you to read all of that, but maybe you can give me a sense of the kinds of things that the community felt strongly needed to be paid attention to.
Our communities as a whole, we got together because we have been historically disinvested. We are in the very southern part of the city. I say if you look at Interstate 95 and look at all the neighborhoods below it, that's us. And what happens is a lot of the resources have stopped. So, I mean, we're asking for what some people may consider basic. We're asking, and not as one, but some things could be shared and some ask are specific to communities. I mean, it could be things such as business incubators, a swimming pool, a library, a rec center or community center, athletic fields, a transportation plan. It's really hard for us to navigate our neighborhoods in that southern end. It's easier to come up here, say, to Charles Street than it is for me to go from Curtis Bay to Lakeland. Capacity building with our CDCs, neighborhood associations.
Capacity building. What do you mean?
You know,
a lot of us
find that in order for us to get things in our community to be able to grow or at least come to a standard as other similar communities, we need to start community development corporations, which some of us have done, to get some of the extras, the above and beyonds, things like that, just to just a business structure to keep resources flowing, to keep just to keep our community alive. So we need as well as community but professional assistance to just maintain our communities.
So what is your reaction when you hear, as some say, and Professor Brown, I understand this is not what you're saying, but mm-hmm. some have said essentially, and these are my words, mm-hmm. that these six communities have sort of sold out cheap, that there aren't that many millions of dollars in this agreement for all the years that this development is going to stretch out, and that you're not getting as much as you should. What's your reaction, having negotiated that?
I've heard that, and often these are critics who live in communities who have what they need. So for us, not only, this is a list that if you asked us, let's just take Sagamore out the picture. If you asked any of us at any given time over the last 30, 40 years, what our community needs, this is what we're going to tell you. So yes, this is our ask, but this doesn't stop. Four out of our six neighborhoods fall in the casino LTC zone, the local development corporation uh-huh. zone. So okay. A few of us fall there. There's also just regular city operating budget things and projects that should be done anyway. So this isn't like the $39 million have to cover. I mean, some of these may happen, some may not. It's just a matter of these are the things that we need to grow, or should I say maintain our communities for the most part. So, you know, I see what people are saying, but $39 million is a lot of money for communities who haven't seen even a fraction of that in the last 50 to 75 years. So okay, that's not the end all be all either. I mean,
okay, there's lots more to talk about, and we will do that after a quick break here. We're going to talk about the future of Port Covington. We're going to talk about how it's financed and what impact it has on the city. And we hope you join the conversation. I'm curious whether you think deals like this are the best way for communities to advocate for themselves. I'm wondering whether you've been following the plans for Port Covington and what you think about that development. Give us a call at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the agreement between Port Covington developer Sagamore and the South Baltimore communities surrounding the project. Brooklyn, Curtis Bay, Cherry Hill, Westport, Mount Winans, and Lakeland. With me in the studio are Keisha Allen, president of the Westport Neighborhood Association and a member of that group of communities called the South Baltimore Six, SB6. Also with me, Lawrence Brown, associate assistant professor at Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy, and Diane Glauber, whom I've been calling Diana. Her name is Diane Glauber, an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who worked with the SB6 to reach this agreement with Sagamore. Diane, I understand that there are two projects in the agreement of all this, all these needs that Keisha Allen was telling us about. Two projects, the college-bound scholarships and a mobile health clinic that Sagamore has agreed to implement. And so that I'm trying to understand kind of why there are some projects that actually are going to happen through funding by Sagamore, and a much larger list of things that are more of a wish list.
Yes, Sagamore has made a commitment for the mobile health clinic and the scholarships already. So this is in addition to this CBA, Community Benefits Agreement. So that was
they're not part of the benefits agreement.
It's not something we negotiated, but it's something that the community will benefit from. And of the scholarships, 50% of all scholarships will be reserved for students that live in the SB6 communities.
Okay. Let me remind listeners, you can be part of this conversation if you think that this is a good approach for the community getting what it needs when there's development in Baltimore. We'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Audrey has called us from Baltimore. Audrey, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you.
And your comment?
I just wanted to comment that Port Covington, from what I've seen of it, is just a pretty empty industrial wasteland. So I think that for anyone to want to redevelop it and pour a lot of money into it is kind of a great thing. So I'm excited for the development to happen, and I'm excited that Sagamore is willing to engage with the community and kind of help them with their needs as well.
Audrey, I appreciate the call. Anyone have a comment, a response? Too odd.
I was going to say we are too.
You are too excited about the development.
That they're willing to partner with us. You don't see that enough, if at all, in cities where usually, you know, developer comes and says, I want that, I bought that. And the city rushes over and says, oh, what do you need? And, you know, they engage with them, but they don't connect with us until a year or two or three down the road. And, you know, we don't have a say. We should have a say earlier on. You know, we can't tell people what to buy, but we should definitely have an input or a seat at the table when things are discussed on how it's going to be, what are you going to build here? How does it impact the communities that border it, especially when they're not at a standard of what you're trying to be? So
I want to pick up on the idea of partnership. That was something that in that clip that we heard from the CEO of Plank Industries, Tom Geddes, talked about this is a partnership. And I noticed in the coverage of it that Senator Bill Ferguson, mm-hmm. State Senator Ferguson, who was part of your negotiating group, I understand, said he thought that was the most important aspect of this agreement was that Sagamore is saying they will fundraise with the communities. Sagamore really isn't putting in all that much money when you think of the size of this project, but they're saying they will be by your side, finding resources, finding ways for the SB6 to continue to have a stream of money to put into some of these community needs that you've identified. And I'm wondering, Lawrence Brown, if that rings true to you, that is as important as the money in the deal, which is pretty much what Senator Ferguson was quoted saying. I mean, you study how communities invest and disinvest and what processes get them there. How confident are you that this linking arms with Sagamore will be a measurably valuable resource for the South Baltimore communities?
Well, I think I want to go to what Keisha was saying about disinvestment, because I think there are a couple of mechanisms by which that happens. One, think about banks, the way that banks redline and subprime those communities. So that's one area that Baltimore needs to cover for the SB6, that we, as in the legal community, we in the civil rights community, need to be pushing so that alongside this $39 million, these communities are also receiving fair lending to help them build and go beyond the $39 to $50 million that's been discussed. So that's a huge part of it. The other part is the city funding, the city allocation of resources. That's another area where disinvestment takes place. So I do have a critique of Sagamore, especially when it relates to the citywide benefits agreement. But I do think that the real issue that many of us have is how the city does not invest in these sort of communities. And it's really up to our elected officials with a deal like this, or Harbor Point with Michael Beatty, or EBDI with Middle East. It's up to our city public elected officials to represent these communities and put the best deal on the table, and to be, quite honestly, always investing in these communities that are disinvested. Communities all over the city that are in Black neighborhoods are wondering why they can't get the type of investment that Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland, or Bolton Hill get in their communities. Why are all the TIFs seemingly concentrated in the White L, if you look at a map of those? And so I think that's the type of issue that we're trying to raise on a broader level. Sagamore can't do everything, but how are we going to tackle redlining, subpriming, and city allocation of resources so that these communities will always have the type of funding and resources that they need?
And do you think this deal makes that more or less likely, this particular deal with SBC?
Well, the sad thing is that Keisha Allen and her community had to negotiate this on their own, that the city wasn't thinking about this up front. They had the initiative to go out and do this, and I actually congratulate them for that. But why didn't this come out up front? Why wasn't this something that city officials said, you know what, we're demanding $50 million for the SB6, and we're going to demand affordable housing, fair housing, and fair wages for people on the citywide level? That has not happened.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Port Covington development and the deal that the developer Sagamore just reached with six of its neighboring communities in South Baltimore: Brooklyn, Curtis Bay, Cherry Hill, Westport, Mount Winans, and Lakeland. You can be part of this conversation. You can tell us what you think about the deal, what you think about the development, whether you have some ideas for how these things ought to be handled. You can send an email to midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Dale has called us from Greenmount West. Dale, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon to all you and all your guests. As I said, I live in Greenmount West, which is part of Station North. And I'm going to put my phone to the window real quick so you can hear some of the construction going on right outside my back window.
Okay, we'll take your word for it.
Okay. We have a lot of development going on in our community that I supported. But as far as the jobs and the actual community benefit that we thought we were going to see, it's not happening. It's not happening, and it's not happening in the degree that we think it should be. We deal with a lot of well-meaning people, but there are gaps in how they apply the law. About a quarter of these jobs already are being staffed by Hispanic men that can't be American citizens in violation of the law. How can we go in these deals with these developers and they don't abide by the law as far as jobs? If the jobs are there, then the developers have to make sure that everybody is abiding by the law. And there's no way that community associations can enforce those things. And this is just a backdoor bribe. I mean, I'm happy for those communities, but it's going to put the rest of the city on the hook.
Dale, I appreciate your raising that question. I want to get the response from folks here in the studio. Thank you, Dale, for the question. Keisha, that's kind of what I was getting at before. Do you think that this essentially sets up a competition between the South Baltimore communities and the rest of the city? Dale feels like it does, like at least his community isn't getting the attention that he thinks you're going to get.
Well, if and he's already gone, I would have been curious to know if he meant relating to Sagamore, this project, or all like future projects.
I think he's talking in general. I heard Dale. You're right. Oh. He's gone. Oh wait, Dale, are you still with us? No, Dale is gone. I heard him as not talking about a TIF deal in particular, talking about the city being good stewards of development for its citizens. Lawrence Brown, you want to
jump in? Sure. Yeah, because I think what he's talking about is like with first I want to address the fact that, you know, folks who are Hispanic are trying to work just like African Americans were trying to work during the Great Migration. So we also have a migration immigrant experience that I think we should.
And I was going to interject that you can't tell by looking at somebody whether they're documented or not.
Right, right. But I think but the heart of the antagonism is that the city, in the case of EBDI, promised 8,000 jobs. As of last check, if you look at Melody Simmons' great article, Too Big to Fail, about EBDI, they had only created like 725 jobs. They promised a community reinvestment fund. That hasn't been set up.
By the way, I should not everybody knows EBDI. East Baltimore Development.
Incorporated. And so I think the heart of what he's trying to say is that no one enforces these deals. And that, again, comes to our city officials. They are the ones who must ensure that developers are held compliant, because the promises are often made well in advance. 8,000 jobs. This is going to be great. But then you look up 15 years later, and only 725 jobs. So who's going to hold Sagamore accountable then becomes a real question. Are there going to be clawback provisions? Are there going to be measures by which we're going to say, you know, we're going to hold you accountable if you fail to meet certain targets?
Diane.
That's certainly, you know, one of our questions as well. And I understand there are a number of points in this 30-year process with the issuance of bonds where we all can weigh in. With our 30-year partnership and having them have a seat at the table, we're hoping to keep that dialogue open so that we can renegotiate as needed at these appropriate steps.
Build, Baltimore's United in Leadership Development, has called for this whole process of approving Port Covington's plans and approving the tax incremental financing for the development to just slow down. Where are you on that? I presume the SB6 has an interest in this not slowing down.
Well, I wouldn't say that. We want everyone to benefit from Port Covington and the city. We're not the only taxpayers in the city, but we also live the closest to it. So my taxes go to Harbor Point. I don't have a daily use for it, but it's that community in that close proximity should be the ones doing like we did. You know, what's going on here? How does this affect me? What's traffic going to be like on Eastern Avenue? Those things. So what we did, we don't want to hurt the gentleman that's in Green Mount West. Hopefully this will start something. When developers come to your community in close proximity, go knock on their door like we did without the city help. We just knock and say, hey, can we talk to you? You know, we don't want to hurt. Everyone should benefit. It doesn't have to be, you know, anyone gets hurt out of this. You know, we have the same issues. We like to see inclusionary housing. We have people in our neighborhoods who need jobs, and it should be able to, not only jobs, but job readiness, you know, without all these stipulations on your past to get jobs.
And since you've raised that, let me ask what you expect. If job training is on your wish list and job training happens because of this agreement, do you think it would be job training just for residents of your part of Baltimore? Or do you think it would be a citywide thing that should be considered
a citywide benefit
from the Port Covington development?
Well, certainly citywide, but there's Sagamore is also receiving a $313 million tax credits for enterprise zone in this deal as well. Now, the enterprise zone legislation is supposed to be to help boost employment in areas that have high unemployment. Mm-hmm. Now, we've never heard specified where whose demographics were used to receive the enterprise zone for Port Covington, since not too many people live there. But when you look at, say, the case of Michael Beattie Harbor Point, they received their enterprise zone because they redrew the map to go around Perkins Homes. And so we're able to receive the enterprise zone, and they extended no benefits to the people living in the Perkins Home public housing community. So my concern, I think, is that there should be a workforce readiness pipeline that does go to, that really taps into neighborhoods that have high unemployment in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. And I think they've targeted 32.9% city residential hiring people from the city. That's too low. We're putting up most of the money. We should be receiving 63% of the jobs, mm-hmm. not 32.9%.
Less than one third. Exactly. Let's talk to Chris, who's called us from Baltimore. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yes. Let me preface this by saying I strongly believe in that any redevelopment deals should directly benefit the adjacent neighborhoods and the people that need it most in this city. What I've had it with as a lifelong resident of this city is the city handing out sweetheart TIFs and tax breaks to these developers that make these grandiose promises that invariably never materialize. It happened with the casino. Somehow, I mean, let's forget for the moment that they just approved a development that's punching 80 holes in the cap, keeping the pollution down at the old Allied Chromium site. Somehow that site in Harbor East was gerrymandered into an empowerment zone. But if all of these deals are going to realize the jobs, the income that they're promising, they shouldn't need this money. They should be willing to come in and say, hey, look, you know what? We're still going to make money. We're going to help you out. But this Sagamore deal, all this TIF and the tax breaks that they've been given were strong-armed through the city council in a closed-door session without any public input. And one of our city councilors even called it a poison deal. So the city really needs to dial this back and not swallow or force us to swallow what these developers all say wholesale.
So, Chris, you're basically, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're basically saying this deal is fine, but it shouldn't take an enormous TIF to produce these kinds of benefits.
Correct, because it's not going to produce the benefits that it's promising to produce in the time frame they're promising it's going to happen.
Chris, I appreciate the call. Let me get a response from anybody here on the panel who wants to address it.
Right, and I think, again, you know, ABDI promised 8,000 jobs, and it just sounds really good. But when you look up 15 years later and there's less than 1,000 jobs produced, you know, and there's no accountability. And that was $78 million in TIF funding there, in addition to other public money, up to $212.6 million, according to Melody Simmons and Joan Jacobson in their story, Too Big to Fail. And I want to clear up, you know, when I talk about segregation, what's the practical implication of that is that you can have low-income families that aren't in lead-ridden homes anymore, that are in neighborhoods with less violence, better schools. So there's a better quality of living for that family and those children that are going to be able to grow up in what will be a community of opportunity. And so I think that's why the housing piece is so important. Jobs are fine, that's income, but housing is wealth. Health is wealth. And I think that's why we are demanding that there's more equity in this project.
We need to take another quick break here. We'll continue discussing this when we get back, the Port Covington development, the financing that's going into it, and what communities nearby and across the city might get out of it. You can join the conversation with a email to midday@wypr.org or a phone call to 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're looking at the 30-year multi-million dollar community benefits agreement reached last week between Port Covington developer Sagamore and communities in South Baltimore, and what that means for those communities and what it may mean for the whole city. I'm speaking with Diane Glauber, an attorney from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She worked with the SB6, the six communities, to reach this agreement with Sagamore. Also, here's Keisha Allen, president of the Westport Neighborhood Association and a member of the South Baltimore Six, and Dr. Lawrence Brown, assistant professor at Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy. Dwight has called us from Green Mountain West, I think with a point about the development. Welcome to the show, Dwight.
Hi, good afternoon, Sheila, and good afternoon to your guest. I heard my brother on a little earlier. I had a quick question about on that specific site, there was a Walmart and a Sam's Club, the largest retailer in the world. And if they couldn't make it on that site, why should we expect this project to be successful? And then I also had a question. Your producers suggested that Cherry Hill, Bay Brook, and Curtis Bay are communities that are involved in this thing, but I'm not sure whether that's the case. And finally, I had a concern about the infrastructure. I thought when the Walmart and the Sam's was there, a certain amount of the infrastructure was in place. And finally, how many more shopping projects, retail places do we need in Baltimore?
Dwight, I appreciate all those questions. I'm not sure whether we have all the expertise to answer them. It was not my impression that retail is a big part of the overall development at Port Covington. But let me throw all your questions out to the folks I have here in the studio. Keisha.
On our end of town, we don't have shopping centers. We don't have the Mondawmin and the Belvedere Square, the Canton Crossing. When we lost that Walmart in January, we lost our mall. That was our pharmacy. That's where we got our goods. We shopped there. That was everything. It may not have been the Super Walmart, but it was ours and we used it. We found out a Friday afternoon, it was released, I think, in a Baltimore Business Journal, that they're closing on Sunday. That left us 2 days to get what we needed quickly. Now, I have a car, but a lot of my residents and people in the area don't. So what happened, Delegate Learman, I believe, is the one who was able to hold Walmart open for an additional week, at least a pharmacy, because you had people didn't have, they couldn't transfer. And then again, it's the weekend. They can't call the doctor on the weekend and say, hey, Walmart's closing today. They left us no time. So maybe it doesn't mean anything to you on that end of town. But on this end, we spend more money in Glen Burnie, Linthicum, and Columbia than we do in the city because it's easier to access. And we lose so much and we haven't got much in return. So,
I appreciate your response to Dwight on that angle, but it raises another question in my mind. I mean, I don't have any expertise, and frankly, I don't think your expertise at this panel is about the economic projections and the potential commercial success of Port Covington. But if it is not, if it doesn't roll out, if the development is not financially successful on the schedule that's been rolled out, what does that mean for what Sagamore has promised to the community? Because one of the criticisms that I read from Build was that it doesn't seem as if the development has looked at alternate economic scenarios. There seemed to be a fairly optimistic prediction of how the economy will roll out, even though some economists say we're probably due for a recession soon because we've been in recovery for quite a few years now. And so I'm just curious as whether that's something that concerns the community. Diane?
Well, we phased it. We have two different phases for the funding for this very reason. The $10 million commitment up front, again, $5 million committed and $5 million to be raised from Sagamore, will happen. It doesn't rise and fall depending on how successful the project is. But having the equity sharing piece certainly does, which is a currently 25 cents per square foot pass through and a portion of the transfer fees per for the commercial space. So it's in everybody's interest, including the SB6, to make sure this project is economically viable, especially in the when we're finished with the $10 million and we're looking at another 25 years of partnership.
But I do think, to your point, Sheila, that there are a lot of questions about the project, particularly, and there have been other groups to raise this, like Port 3, People Organized for Responsible TIFs, Tax Breaks, and Transformation, that have been pushing for like a sensitivity analysis that would normally be conducted. And that's also what the build expert that they brought in mentioned, that you don't just need one projection of how this thing may go. You need a projection that say, well, what if there are two recessions, over a 41-year period? You know, there may be another Great Depression, you know, so don't just present the rosy scenario. Also present the scenarios of what may happen in bad cases so that we can evaluate looking at different forecasts, not just the rosy forecast. And so I think Barbara Samuels from ACLU has mentioned, you know, there's probably been a market analysis conducted in terms of who they would like to be marketing these residential units for, but they haven't released it to the public so that we can evaluate this market analysis as well. So there are lots of questions because this thing has been pushed so quickly down the railroad that people haven't had time to really evaluate this on all the merits that it deserves to be evaluated on.
Tamika is calling us from Baltimore. Tamika, welcome to the show.
Yes, good afternoon to each of you. My comment is, one, I don't believe that really the city leaders wanted the community to really have a say in any of these meetings. Second, we're speaking about a projection that's 30 years out. Rather than setting aside affordable housing, why not say, listen, this is what we can do now. We can support you as far as going to school, getting your education or trades that you can afford to live in that community. I think that would be more better than trying to set aside all these low-income houses. How do you help the residents to improve? Maybe some of them already are, but they may need assistance as far as education so that they can garner the jobs that are for the 21st century. Thank you.
Tamika, thanks for making that point. Keisha Allen, do you want to respond to Tamika?
That's why we mentioned job readiness. Some people will have to be trained. But we also have VOTEC high schools here as well. So, I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are ready and able, you know, to work. But all the jobs are construction. What about when office buildings are built? You know, we have secretaries, we have administrators, things like that. It should be where a little bit of everyone can benefit. But that's why we said this is 30 years out. So we take, you know, a group now and it takes them 2 years, 3 years. You know, they can still come in at whatever phase of the project and just jump right in and help. You know, it should be ongoing. That's why we said job readiness. We know some aren't ready, but some, you know, we want to get them trained. We just don't want to say, okay, you're not ready. You're never going to be able to get a job there. Let's, and there are, you know, organizations here that can facilitate that. So.
But I think her point about education, you know, if we allow people with housing choice vouchers to move into Port Covington, that does allow children to have better education. The schools that will be there, they will have access to those. So I think the point about education, housing enhances education. Housing choice will enhance education in Port Covington.
So what do you consider at this point the most crucial things to be included in approving Port Covington and its associated financing, most important for the entire city?
Three things. Number one, affordable housing, 20%, which is what the inclusionary housing law intends. Number two, fair housing, making sure people with housing choice vouchers are able to live in that community. I'd say at a 10% rate, that's roughly 720 residences, so that African-Americans who have been historically disenfranchised, placed in a public housing, as was decided in Thompson versus Hood, would have access to a community of opportunity. And number three, living wages, that people who are working in those retail jobs aren't just earning $11 an hour, but $15 an hour as well. And we have other things, but I think those are the top three.
And Lawrence Brown was just you're speaking about
citywide,
about benefits that should accrue to the entire city. Diane Glauber, I want to ask you before we're completely out of time about the deal with the South Baltimore Six, the six closest neighboring communities. How will that be enforceable? What happens to it? Will it be an actual like written part of the city's approval of the Port Covington package? I mean, tell us legally what this means.
From my understanding, it will be attached to the city council approval of the TIF, so it will be legally binding.
And we've talked about a little bit about, I mean, there are some specific numbers of money mm-hmm. and money that's to be raised from unnamed sources, and that, you know, there's obviously not every detail that can be spelled out. But then there's this whole idea of Sagamore being a partner to the SB6 communities in more fundraising and in all kinds of developments. How can something like that be enforceable?
Well, we're planning to create a new entity of which Sagamore will have one seat, and the six communities as part of the SB6 will also have a seat. So they will have one vote, and the community will have six votes to determine how the priorities are with funding. So that, I think, is important to show that it will continue to be community-driven. In addition, they have committed to providing technical assistance and advocacy. And it's sort of a shame that these communities have to depend on Sagamore to advocate for them. And that's certainly a weakness that we've seen with the city. But the technical assistance in economic development and housing and so on will also be very beneficial to the communities.
I'm going to try to take a real quick call from Alvin, calling us from Baltimore. Alvin, we've got just 2 minutes left. What is your point?
My point is I don't see how people don't see the writing on the wall where that once Sagamore and Under Armour comes into this property in the surrounding areas where those neighborhoods will no longer be the neighborhoods that we know of. I don't see how they will invest or that the TIF money, that the money that they're giving back is going to actually help these communities in the sense that they will not take those communities and make them an upper income area, especially when you got waterfront property down there.
Alvin,
and you're putting all the type of shops.
I appreciate you raising it. Who wants to give a brief response to Alvin about your perspective on this? Alvin is pretty pessimistic.
Those things can happen anyway. I mean, it just can happen. This isn't at least Westport's not our first go around with development. What we like to do is try to mitigate that. We like to, we're looking for new neighbors. We have the space. We don't want to see us get kicked out like we've seen over East Baltimore 10 years ago. There's enough space for everyone to come in, enjoy each neighborhood, help build it to be a better place that it can be. And we all live happily ever after. But reality is we don't know. And we'll cross that bridge at that time.
There's obviously lots of questions and we're flat out of time, so we have to leave it there. But I hope we can keep in touch with you as this develops. And I'm really grateful to you for this conversation. Diane Glauber, an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who worked with the SB6 to reach this agreement. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Keisha Allen, president of the Westport Neighborhood Association. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Lawrence Brown, assistant professor at Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy. Thanks
Always
so much.
A pleasure.
Lunch for our guests provided by Bee Bistro, located at 1501 Bolton Street, with nightly specials featuring new American local, seasonal, and organic offerings. Outside seating available. Open for dinner Tuesday through Sunday and for Sunday brunch. Online at bee-bistro.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in Monday. Walmart and McDonald's are among the corporations that have vowed to do better when it comes to animal welfare. Is consumer demand changing the face of industrial farming? Tune in Monday for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great weekend. Stay cool.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.